Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. The Australian government has announced that it will be closing its refugee detention centre on Manus Island, though the government has insisted that none of those detained will be settled in Australia.
The Uruguayan foreign minister this week expressed anger at supposed bullying from northern neighbours Brazil over its desire to block Venezuela from the Mercosur trading bloc. We'll be asking why.
Over 500,000 people took to the streets of the Guinean capital Conakry in an anti-government protest over the mishandling of the Simandou iron ore project and alleged government corruption.
As yet another organisation launches to influence the future of the UK Labour Party, Labour Tomorrow, we'll be looking at exactly what the roles of such organisations are and what their financial relationship is to the party as a whole.
Is there a standoff in the Horn of Africa between China and the United States? With China launching its first overseas military base in the small African nation of Djibouti, we look at the geopolitical impact this could have.
And it's not a place you might traditionally associate with beer-fueled merriment, but North Korea, of all places, is into its second week of a beer festival, and we'll have more on that at the end of the programme.
All that's coming up over the next half hour on today's edition of World in Focus.
Following on from the revelations of abuse at the Australian-run overseas detention centres over the past weeks, today the Australian government has announced the closure of their Manus Island detention centre in Papua New Guinea. Like the detention centre on Nauru that we reported on last week, Manus Island itself has been the subject of several allegations of abuse, with UN agencies and several human rights organisations accusing the Australian government of shirking its responsibilities towards refugees and asylum seekers.
In April, a Supreme Court ruling in Papua New Guinea deemed the Manus Island detention centre to be unconstitutional. The announcement of the closure of the facility doesn't seem to be a reaction to concerns over the welfare of those held there, but the result of pressure from Papua New Guinean authorities. Australia's Immigration Minister, Peter Dutton, when announcing the closure of Manus Island, which currently houses 854 men, said, quote, "No one from Manus Island Regional Processing Centre will ever be settled in Australia." He added that it was the long-standing position of the government to work with Papua New Guinea, or PNG as it's commonly referred to, quote, "support those people as they transition into PNG or return to their country of origin." There is currently no timeline for the closure of the centre.
The announcement came hours after a statement was released calling for the immediate closure of Manus Island and the Australian Detention Centre on the Pacific Island of Nauru, signed by over 100 doctors, teachers, caseworkers and social workers who have first-hand experience in working across both centres. Some of the signatories to the statement had also been responsible for writing the incident reports highlighting a damning level of abuse in Nauru, which were leaked to the Guardian newspaper last week.
The president of Nauru, however, told Channel News Asia that the reports of abuse in Nauru had been cooked up.
No, those are all unfounded. There are people that are, you know, advocates, you know, and those sorts of people who are wanting to discredit the program are always quick to put out negative stuff in the media.
Baron Waka, the president of Nauru, speaking to Channel News Asia.
Adam Makero is just one of over 100 former employees and aid workers in Nauru and Manus Island who have today signed the statement asking for the immediate closure of these centres and the transfer of those detained to Australia. He joins us on the line now. Adam, you and your colleagues state that this situation has reached crisis level, yet many Australian officials are still denying the legitimacy of the reports. Peter Dutton dismissed the reports, saying many were fabricated. And on top of that, the president of Nauru has this week said that the reports are cooked up and that the regional processing centre has been going very, very well. What's your response to these dismissals?
My initial reaction, Caroline, was one of disbelief about these dismissals. Like I've previously stated, these incident reports were written on Nauru by myself, by my colleagues who are professionals. We acted in a professional capacity as part of our core duties. They are not written by advocates. They're not written by laypersons either. Therefore, comments such as being cooked up or are not real are disheartening, and it's difficult to see how those comments are made. I think the fact that we are not advocates on the island when we wrote them, it means they're very difficult to dismiss. Further, if you look at the incident reports and the Nauru files, they have been corroborated by a lot of different reports. I was having a look at them earlier today. There's reports from the Australian Human Rights Commission. There's reports from Amnesty International. There's reports from Human Rights Watch. There was an Australian Senate inquiry. These reports all speak to what we wrote, all leading to these being very hard to dismiss.
Now, today, the Australian government have announced that the Manus Island Centre will be closed. However, the closure seems to have less to do with the Australian government having concerns over the welfare of those held there. They were pushed into this by the Papua New Guinea authorities, who in April ruled that the prison camp was unconstitutional. Do you think that a similar stance may now be taken by lawmakers in Nauru?
I'd like to see a similar stance taken in Nauru. I'm hesitant to celebrate the closing of the Manus Detention Centre, given that the Australian government said that those men in Manus will still be resettled in Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea is not safe. It's not a durable resettlement country, in my belief. Similarly, in Nauru, if the detention centre is closed, I would expect that the Australian or Nauruan government announced that settlement will occur in Nauru, which is just as untenable.
And Peter Dutton himself said, and I quote, "No one from Manus Island Regional Processing Centre will ever be settled in Australia." I mean, what really are the alternative options? If they can't be safely settled in Papua New Guinea, surely they wouldn't consider trying to send these asylum seekers back to where they came from, would they?
I think this goes against principles of non-refoulement under UN law, under international law. These men are from countries where they are persecuted. Some cannot be returned. Therefore, we're calling for the centres to close down and all these men, women, children to be brought immediately to Australia in safety. I think releasing the men of Papua New Guinea into the community would have disastrous effects. I was there in Papua New Guinea in the lead up to a disturbance that saw one asylum seeker murdered, another violent attacks, and recently I've seen other violent attacks within Manus and Nauru. So the option of resettlement in those countries is non-tenable. The only option I see is to bring them to Australia immediately to reduce the harm that's being suffered by these people.
And just finally, really, I guess for you and for your colleagues, the work continues, and I imagine you will continue trying to fight for settlement in Australia. Surely the cost to the Australian government in holding these people in these overseas detention centres and dealing with these inquiries is probably higher than the cost of trying to settle these people in Australia and integrating them into society, is it not?
It is higher. It's much higher. That's in numerous surveys and studies. This is a billion-dollar industry in Nauru and Manus Island, Papua New Guinea. It needs to be stopped right now. The eyes of the world are on Australia on this. And given the unprecedented global crisis on refugees at the moment, it's a drop in the ocean. It's easy to fix. Australia has the capacity and means to bring these people to Australia. It should be done immediately.
Adam, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much, Caroline. Thanks.
The Uruguayan Foreign Minister Nin Novoa this week expressed anger at what he described as bullying from northern neighbours Brazil.
Novoa claimed that Brazil's Foreign Minister José Serra attempted to buy his country's support in blocking Venezuela's upcoming seat in the South American Mercosur trading bloc's rotating presidency. The Mercosur Southern Common Market is a sub-regional trading bloc consisting of Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay and Venezuela.
Venezuela has been a fully-fledged member of the bloc since 2012, although its status has proved controversial, particularly in recent years as the country faces an ongoing economic crisis under the presidency of embattled President Nicolas Maduro. What effectively happened, according to their foreign minister, is that Brazil had offered Uruguay a partnership in a major trade offensive in Africa and Iran, but that was conditional on their support in pushing for the blocking of Venezuela's presidency of Mercosur.
With me on the line now is Francisco Dominguez, the head of Latin American Studies Research at Middlesex University in London. Thank you for speaking with us, Francisco. Now, Venezuela's membership of the Mercosur bloc has always been a controversial one. How much of this is simply a continuation of that bad blood towards the country, as opposed to a reaction to contemporary problems under Maduro's presidency?
Venezuela applied to become member of the Mercosur more than 12 years ago, 13 I think, and it had to wait for 10 years. And the reason was that the right-wing dominated Congress in Paraguay, which is a very reactionary country, politically at least anyway, blocked it. And the reason is the acceptance of any new member into Mercosur requires not only that whoever is in government in the various members of the Mercosur agree to the new member, but this has got to be approved by the parliaments of every single country. In the case of Venezuela, all the other countries, with no exception, approved it. And Paraguay held it for 10 years until there was a moment when there was a coup against Fernando Lugo, the former bishop. What happened was that the Mercosur countries applied the democratic clause, which exists in Mercosur, and suspended Paraguay. And immediately, almost immediately, literally 24, 48 hours after, all the governments that were members of Mercosur immediately approved the incorporation of Venezuela into Mercosur. And Paraguay later on was restored back into Mercosur, but it was in no position to stop it. And that's why what is going on now is a continuation of the same politics of right-wing opposition to the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela.
Brazil, under the presidency of Dilma Rousseff, has been reasonably close to Venezuela. Are these events perhaps a sign of the interim Michel Temer leadership flexing its muscles in anticipation of a Rousseff impeachment?
I don't think it's flexing its muscles. What it is the United States, and it's good to go to that, you know, dimension, is very, very keen to dismantle as much as possible and to complicate as much as possible all the instances of regional integration that exist in Latin America, because they're inimical to their interests, as they understand it, they're right. And Mercosur is such an interesting regional integration, economic and political integration, that it challenges, you know, their domination and hegemony in the region. So therefore, now they have the possibility of influencing the interim government of Temer quite openly. They're using this. I mean, Macri in Argentina, but also José Serra, the foreign minister of the interim government of Temer in Brazil, is sort of going for it. And the problem they have is Uruguay is not prepared to accept it. And then they were very, very angry, obviously, that José Serra went even as far as to try to bribe them, which is completely unacceptable.
Well, as you say, Uruguay has said pretty explicitly that it will have no part in boycotting Venezuela's role in Mercosur. How might that then play in the longer term in terms of relationships in the region?
Well, it is possible if the right wing gets away with their program. That is to say, if they manage to finally oust Dilma Rousseff for, you know, now, which is going to, the vote is going to take place in the next few days. If Argentina manages to consolidate their position, and if all the right-wing governments in the region, in South America, particularly who are members of Mercosur, manage to block Venezuela, if they cannot block it, I think they're going to go for dismantling it, because that's the program of the United States. I doubt very much that they will be able to do this, because the benefits, economically speaking, accruing to each one of the countries will make them think twice before they go for this. But we have to wait and see. But it's not flexing of the muscle, it's the United States.
Francisco Dominguez, thank you very much for speaking to us.
My pleasure.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Over 500,000 people took to the streets of the Guinean capital, Conakry, in anti-government protests. We'll be discussing why in just a moment.
As yet another organisation launches to influence the future of the UK Labour Party, Labour Tomorrow, we'll be looking at exactly what their roles are and what their financial relationship is to the party as a whole.
Is there a standoff in the Horn of Africa between China and the United States as China launches their first overseas military base?
And it's not a place you might traditionally associate with beer-fueled merriment, but North Korea, of all places, is into the second week of a beer festival. We'll have more at the end of the programme.
All that's coming up over the next half hour on today's edition of World in Focus.
Over 500,000 people took to the streets of Guinea's capital, Conakry, yesterday in anti-government protests. This is just the latest of several protests against the ruling government of the West African nation since the 2008 military coup.
The anti-government demonstrators said that the country's economy has suffered under President Alpha Condé, and reports suggest that these recent protests were over the government's mishandling of the Simandou iron ore project in the south of the country, which is managed by the British-Australian firm Rio Tinto. Police opened fire on the protesters in an attempt to disperse the crowds, resulting in dozens being injured and one young man being killed. Investigations are now being launched into the death of the 21-year-old, as reports suggest that he was sitting on the third-floor balcony of a building when he was shot by police in the chest.
Joining us on the line is Sean Smith, a West Africa political risk analyst at Verisk and Maplecroft, a UK-based global risk analytics and research company. Sean, there have been a number of protests and rallies since the 2008 military coup. It's reported that the protests this week are related to the government's handling of the Simandou project, but are these projects this week, the protests this week, sorry, more a continuation of ongoing political unrest and a disillusionment with the democratic system?
Yes, I would say that there's a combination of a number of factors here. The failure to develop the Simandou project is certainly a central component of these protests. It's widespread disillusionment with how the project has promised so little but delivered, promised so much but delivered so little. And combine this with high levels of youth unemployment and ongoing grievances against the government, which many people perceive to be of questionable legitimacy. And you have, as you mentioned, you have the long history of opposition protests against the government, which have frequently been met by force. So this is just I would say this is more of a continuation of what's gone on before, combined with latest developments.
And last November's election was contested by the opposition leaders, and there were allegations of vote rigging and fraud. Guinea's Constitutional Court, however, dismissed the claims and upheld the election result. Do you happen to know if there were any objective observers overseeing the elections?
Yes, the EU sent an election observation mission to Guinea. They concluded in their report that the election was valid but was fraught with lots of difficulties. They criticised the National Electoral Commission for failing to deliver coherent and timely voter registration lists. Many of the polling stations opened late. Many of the polling stations didn't have booths. So there were a lot of flaws. This was not a perfect election by any means, but in the end, the EU decided that the overall outcome was valid.
And just finally, if you don't mind me asking, do you think that this situation will wash over, or do you think that with these ongoing protests, there may be yet another election and that there may be stricter rules on the election and electoral law?
I wouldn't anticipate another election, but I would anticipate further bouts of civil unrest directed against the government. With commodities being so lowly priced internationally, there's little sign that the Simandou project is going to be revived. And in addition to that, the government does not seem to have any answers to reduce the spiralling youth unemployment.
Well, Sean Smith, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Our movement, our Labour movement, was founded on the most immense struggle. Those that laid down their lives in the 18th and 19th century. Those that were gunned down campaigning for the right to vote. Those that were gunned down trying to become trade unionists. Not just here, but all around the world. It's the spirit of hope or the spirit of despair. Which are we? We're obviously hope, not despair.
The UK Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn addressing crowds of his supporters earlier this year. Jeremy Corbyn won the leadership of the UK's main opposition party last year in a landslide vote of almost 60% of party members. Indeed, opinion polling within the Labour Party suggests that he has maintained that popularity a year on.
Despite that, however, there is a major push, particularly within the parliamentary party, to oust him from the leadership in an ongoing ideological battle which has pitted the traditional left of the party, for whom Corbyn is now a figurehead, against the more centrist centrist and some would even say conservative wing, whose roots can be traced largely to the governments of Tony Blair between 1997 and 2007.
Amidst the division within the party, a couple of organisations have emerged in support of a change in leadership, Saving Labour and more recently Labour Tomorrow.
Yes, and Labour Tomorrow has received several high-profile donations, namely £25,000 from the Liberal Democrat peer Matthew Oakeshott and £180,000 from the hedge fund manager Martin Taylor, a long-time donor to the UK Labour Party. One of the directors of the organisation is the Labour peer and former Home Secretary under Tony Blair, David Blunkett.
Joining me on the line now from Glasgow is the journalist and commentator James Dolman. Thanks for talking to us, James. When you look at the Labour Party right now, there seems to be a lot of organisations outside of, or at least on the fringes of, Labour involved in a political tug of war. Would it therefore be fair to suggest that the party itself is, albeit temporarily, out of action or on hold?
I think you have to look at a little bit of a historical perspective about Labour. It's always been a coalition of various different organisations, the trade unions, the parliamentary party, the membership, even the co-op at one point. So Labour's always been, because of the nature of Britain's two-party system, it's always been a big, broad coalition of lots and lots of different groups, all, if you like, fighting out within Labour. So it's always been a fractious organisation internally because of that big coalition. So I don't think at the moment there's anything unusual in the fact that lots of different people are trying to influence it. It's very much, if you've got history of the Labour Party, that's always been the case.
These organisations, and I include Momentum in that category, are they campaigning groups as such, or perhaps would it be fairer to say that they are maybe a means of funnelling money without having to go through the party machine itself, especially when that machine is so fractured?
I suppose we could say that. I mean, I think what different groups are trying to do is mobilise. I mean, to look back at the historical change, Labour used to be run by trade union barons. Essentially, the trade union bloc ran the Labour Party, along with the parliamentary party. Mm. One of the side effects of Ed Miliband's election, with opening up to the membership, one member, one vote, has meant suddenly that huge member, and Labour's now, let's not forget, the biggest political party in Europe. Mm. The battle for that, the souls of those members, the battle for the 600,000 members' votes, suddenly becomes key to British politics. So it's not difficult to understand that other organisations would pile in and try and pull those people to their side.
I would just finally ask you more about the internal politics of the Labour Party at the moment. Obviously, it's divided. Do you think that these divisions are likely to scar the Labour Party for good? Can it emerge from this the same party?
That's the question. I think in an age, there needs to be, in some ways one could argue that there needs to be a fundamental realignment of British politics, where you've got the UKIP Tory right on one side, the Blairites and the Cameroons and the Lib Dems in the middle, and a Corbyn left Labour Party on the left. That would be the logical way that British politics would end up. Sadly, British politics is rarely logical, but you could see a situation where the Blairite right-wing Labour Party split, join the Lib Dems and the Cameroons, the UKIP and the Tory Party gets together, and the Corbyn Labour Party is left. That seems to be the logical conclusion of what's going on at the moment.
James Dolman, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Is there a standoff in the Horn of Africa between China and the United States? The Republic of Djibouti is a small country in the Horn of Africa that sits on the coast of the Gulf of Aden, leading into the Suez Canal, a vital waterway used for the international transportation of oil and other materials.
The country has played a geostrategically important role, for the United States as a power projection hub against terror cells in the Middle East and North Africa. The US base, Camp Lemonnier, is home to upward of 4,000 US military personnel and has also been used as a base for the US Navy and Air Force in counter-piracy operations in the Gulf of Aden. But now China has decided to set up camp in the small country too, installing thousands of troops and staff at its first ever overseas military base, a move that the United States Congress has referred to as worrisome.
The Foreign Minister of Djibouti, Mahmoud Ali Youssef, has said that his country welcomes a Chinese military base just as it welcomed Western bases. It's understandable that Djibouti would welcome both bases, given that the United States pays $63 million annually to rent its base, and it has been estimated that China will bring around $100 million for theirs, in addition to both countries making contributions to Djibouti's infrastructural projects. Earlier today, Matthew Aiton spoke to Martin Plout about this new development.
Okay, so Martin Plaut, specialist in the Horn of Africa and columnist for The Guardian, thank you very much for joining us on Sputnik Radio.
It's a pleasure.
So first of all, so what do China and the US have to gain from having a military presence in Djibouti?
Well, you know, it is an extremely important part of the world. I mean, you know, even as long ago as the First World War, you know, the great powers, Turkey, Germany, Britain, and the others all competed for the area because, of course, it is the way most trade goes through between the East and the Europeans and through the Suez Canal. So control of the area is absolutely vital. And then, of course, you have the oil from the Saudis and from the rest of the Arab world. So it is an absolutely vital area in the world. Plus, you have all the goods going in the opposite direction. And, of course, you have had a lot of piracy in the past, you know, around the Horn of Africa with the various Somali groups, you know, acting there. So people are very aware of the importance of the Horn and of the region in general to trade and in both directions.
Okay, to what extent has the US's base in Djibouti played a role in its combating of terrorism in the region, in North Africa and the Middle East?
Oh, it's been absolutely critical. I mean, they are very active against Al-Shabaab in Somalia and also against various forms of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So it is an extremely important base for them. It is also the only full base that the United States has on the African continent. And so as well as running, you know, drones and various operations, special operations, most of which are covert and never reported, in the Horn of Africa and probably further beyond, it is also a base from which they can resupply and supply their troops anywhere on the African continent.
Moving back to US-China relations, do you think that this could further escalate tensions between the two countries, given that both are already at one another's throats in the South China Sea?
Well, I doubt it, because quite frankly, the Chinese and the Americans have been working with people like the Indians and a whole host of other naval presences off the Horn of Africa in order to try and halt the piracy, which has now effectively been halted. The Somali pirates that were taking such a terrible toll on shipping for the last, nearly a decade, have been wrapped up. And that was a joint effort in which everybody participated, including the Chinese. So I don't see this as being a huge escalation in any of this. And although the Americans, of course, like to, you know, keep their, you know, things to themselves, and, you know, the fact that you have the Americans there, you have the French, French have a base in Djibouti, the fact the Chinese are coming, I don't think is going to be a massive issue for the Americans. I mean, the South China Sea, in which, of course, there is huge competition now between the Americans and the Chinese because of the islands. You know, that is a much more serious issue. I don't really see the Horn of Africa as being an area in which there is tremendous competition, but of course there's some rivalry.
So why exactly is it, do you think, then, that the United States is kicking up such a fuss about China establishing a base in Djibouti?
Well, I haven't seen the State Department coming out with statements. These are, you know, congressmen, and, you know, they're congressmen who are concerned about everything under the sun. And, you know, let's see how this develops. I mean, maybe it will become a much more serious issue, but at the moment it doesn't really seem to be that way. And, you know, there are issues, as I say, on which the Chinese and the Americans cooperate. And they would, of course, also cooperate on Islamic fundamentalism because, you know, the Chinese are just as worried with the Uyghurs in the far west of China and growing Islamism in their areas. So, you know, there are areas in which the Chinese and the Americans cooperate, and there are areas in which the Chinese and the Americans compete. And, you know, I think this isn't the Horn of Africa is probably somewhere where there's more cooperation than competition.
Okay, Martin Plaut, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
And finally, Carolyn, if I were to refer to the Oktoberfest of the North, where do you think I'd be talking about?
I'd probably think it was somewhere north of Germany, in Scandinavia, or somewhere like that. But since we've mentioned this story already today, Jack, I obviously know that you're talking about North Korea.
I'm talking about North Korea, yeah.
Like I just said.
Yeah, like you said and like I said. Well, anyway, North Korea launched its first ever beer festival last week, which has seen locals and tourists alike soaking up the atmosphere in a floating restaurant in Pyongyang. At least that's according to North Korea's General Bureau of Public Service. The festival offers those in attendance a selection of beers, the pièce de résistance being brews from the Taedongyang Brewery, which was founded by Kim Jong-il.
I didn't realise he was into brewing beer.
I'm not entirely sure he was particularly. It probably has a lot more to do with the fact that he founded a lot of things.
Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget that you can find out more about everything we've been discussing and a whole lot more over at sputniknews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Until tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster.
And me, Carolyn Scott. Goodbye.
Goodbye.